Imagine lying next to the person you love most in the world, in this, perfectly safe room. The doors are locked, the lighting is soft.
Right, completely secure.
Exactly. But inside your body, your brain is actively flooding your bloodstream with the exact same chemical cocktail you would need to, outrun a predator.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
Your heart rate spikes, your muscles tense up, your digestion just shuts down completely. To the outside world, you are engaged in an act of profound intimacy. But internally.
Internally, you are literally fighting for your life. It is a devastating biological paradox. I mean, the very environment that is designed for connection becomes this ultimate trigger for a survival response. And we see this profound disconnect when we look at the invisible architecture of intimacy.
And that invisible architecture is exactly our mission today. So we have a profoundly important stack of sources to go through for you, the listener.
We really do.
If you are navigating the complexities of a relationship, or you're trying to understand how to rebuild safely from trauma, or even just trying to grasp how these hidden physiological realities dictate our capacity to truly enjoy sex.
Right, which is huge.
This deep dive is absolutely for you. We are pulling from a series of highly detailed articles from Thinkiverse.
And they unpack the really deep psychological and physiological impacts of childhood sexual trauma on adult female sexuality.
They do, but they also pair this analysis with some really fascinating parallel sources.
Yeah, that part was super interesting.
Right. It's about the relational ripple effects of men who intentionally practice interrupted sex. So specifically, sex without ejaculation.
The juxtaposition in this source materials is just striking. I mean, we are looking at two very, very different phenomena that result in a remarkably similar relational breakdown. On one side, we have this involuntary physiological response that is born from trauma. And on the other, we have an entirely voluntary physical disruption born from, a specific belief system or a specific goal.
But in both scenarios, the person on the other side of the bed is left experiencing the exact same feelings of isolation and rejection.
Exactly.
Okay, let's unpack this because I feel like we cannot begin to talk about communication or boundaries or rebuilding a relationship until we really understand the biological mechanisms operating beneath the surface.
No, you have to understand the why and the how first.
Right, we have to start there. And the sources center heavily on this concept called sexual self schemas.
Yeah, so a sexual self scheme is essentially it's your brain's internal filing system for intimacy.
Okay, a filing system.
Right. From the moment we are born, our brains are furiously building these cognitive blueprints for literally everything we encounter.
Like everything.
Yeah, I mean, we have schemas for how to behave in a grocery store or how to interpret a dog wagging its tail, and fundamentally, how to perceive and engage with our own sexuality.
Okay, so what does a normal or I guess healthy schema look like?
Well, a healthy sexual self schema associates physical intimacy with connection, pleasure, vulnerability, and, a baseline of safety. It tells the body that this specific type of physical closeness is a positive, rewarding experience.
But the Thinkiverse articles map out exactly how childhood sexual trauma completely hacks that blueprint.
It really does, because the brain's primary job, above all else, is survival.
It prioritizes threat detection over everything else.
Absolutely. So when a child experiences sexual trauma, their highly neuroplastic brain just rewrites that internal framework.
It just changes the whole blueprint.
Exactly. It strips away the associations of pleasure and connection, and it inextricably links sexual activity to fear, profound shame, and this terrifying loss of control.
And the thing is, that doesn't just become a bad memory, right? That becomes the new operational baseline.
Right. The brain essentially recategorizes intimacy from a reward stimulus to a threat stimulus.
And this cognitive imprint is incredibly stubborn from what I read. It persists deep into adulthood.
Oh, very deep.
Like you could be in your 30s, deeply in love, married to a partner who is objectively gentle and supportive.
Yes, completely safe.
But the moment intimacy begins, your brain's filing system pulls the blueprint from the folder labeled imminent danger.
Yeah, and that cognitive framework is not just some psychological abstraction. It triggers a massive cascading physiological response.
The actual body reacts.
Exactly. The sources detail how this altered schema leads to chronic dysregulation of the autonomic nervous system.
Okay, wait, let's break that down. To understand why a survivor's body reacts the way it does, we have to look at the mechanics of that nervous system, right?
Yeah. So the autonomic nervous system basically has two main branches.
the gas and the brakes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You have the sympathetic nervous system, which is our gas pedal, our fight or flight response.
Right.
And then the parasympathetic nervous system, which is the brake pedal. That one is responsible for rest, digestion, and crucially, physical arousal.
Right. So in a healthy sexual encounter, the body requires this delicate dance between the two.
It does, but it leans heavily on the parasympathetic system.
The brake pedal.
Right. To allow for physical arousal, lubrication, and relaxation of the pelvic floor muscles. I mean, you cannot become physically aroused if your body thinks it is about to be eaten by a bear.
Wow. Yeah, you just can't. That is a biological bottom line.
It is. For trauma survivors, the altered sexual schema causes this hyperactivation of the sympathetic nervous system during intimate moments.
So the gas pedal just gets slammed down.
Exactly. The brain perceives a threat, and the hypothalamus sends a signal straight to the adrenal glands.
And they just pump adrenaline, right?
Right. They instantly pump epinephrine and cortisol into the bloodstream. The body prepares to literally fight or flee.
Which means blood is actually shunted away from the digestive and reproductive organs, right?
Yes. It's pushed toward the major muscle groups in the arms and legs so you can run.
Wow. And this is why the sources point out that this manifests as a profound sexual dysfunction.
Yeah. Severely diminished desire and inability to physically arouse. And even things like vaginismus or severe physical pain during intercourse.
Because the body is literally clenching, it's bracing for an attack.
It is.
It's the ultimate misfiring of a system that is actually working perfectly.
Right. The system itself isn't broken.
It makes me think of a smoke detector.
Oh, that's a good analogy.
Yeah, like if you have a smoke detector that was calibrated while you were trapped in a burning building, it learned exactly what a life-threatening fire smells like.
Right, and it saved you. You survived.
Exactly. But now, decades later, you are in a perfectly safe kitchen making toast with someone you love.
The toast gets a little brown.
A tiny wisp of smoke goes up, and that detector unleashes a deafening, absolute alarm.
It just screams at you to evacuate immediately.
Right. The smoke detector isn't broken. It is doing exactly what it was programmed to do under extreme duress.
It's just operating in completely the wrong context.
So what is that smoke detector in the brain?
That mechanism is the amygdala. It is the brain's primitive threat detection center, and it operates in milliseconds.
Milliseconds, wow.
Yeah, it is scanning the environment constantly, you know, matching current sensory inputs against past traumas.
But here's what I want to push back on, or at least ask about.
Okay, go for it.
If my prefrontal cortex, like the logical conscious part of my brain, knows for an absolute fact that the person touching me is my safe, loving husband or wife.
Right.
Why doesn't the rest of the body get the memo? Why does the physical imprint completely bypass logical thought?
It's so frustrating for people.
I think a lot of people struggle with the guilt of that, feeling like they should be able to just think their way out of a trauma response.
The inability to just think your way out of it really comes down to evolutionary biology and the speed of neural processing.
The speed of it.
Right. The prefrontal cortex, where your logic and conscious thought reside, is a relatively slow processor.
Okay.
It takes time to analyze a situation, weigh all the evidence, and conclude, like, yes, we are safe.
But the amygdala is faster.
The amygdala is built for pure speed. Think about it in the wild. If you wait for your logical brain to confirm that the rustling in the bushes is actually a tiger,
you're already dead.
Exactly. You're dead. So when a sensory input during intimacy, you know, a specific touch, the weight of a body, even just the emotional vulnerability of the moment.
If it matches a fragment of that traumatized schema.
The amygdala fires the alarm instantly. It triggers the HPA axis, flooding the body with stress hormones before the prefrontal cortex even has a chance to log on to the network.
Wow, before it even logs on.
Yeah. By the time your logical brain says, wait, this is my spouse, we are safe, your physiological state is already radically altered.
The muscles have already clamped down.
The fear response is already roaring through your veins.
That is such a crucial piece of the puzzle for you listening right now. The sheer tragedy of feeling betrayed by your own biological hardware.
It is devastating.
Because a survivor might desperately want to connect, to be present, to enjoy the moment.
But they're blocked by a survival mechanism that's prioritizing safety over connection.
And the text talks about how this creates a brutal self-perpetuating feedback loop.
It really does.
Because if every single time you try to be intimate, your body goes into fight or flight and you experience physical pain or just a complete numbness,
right,
you inevitably develop profound anxiety about the next time you try to be intimate.
The anxiety becomes a secondary schema.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The pain and lack of arousal lead to this anticipatory dread. And that dread leads to avoidance.
Which makes sense.
Right. The avoidance then validates the brain's assumption that intimacy is a threat that needs to be managed, which just further entrenches the trauma response.
So the body learns to associate the partner's approach not with love, but with the impending stress of having to endure a triggered physiological state.
Exactly.
Okay, but if the survivor's body is physically screaming danger, how does the person lying next to them misinterpret that biological freeze as a personal rejection?
That's the million-dollar question.
Because from the outside, it seems like a massive leap for a partner to see someone shutting down in fear and internalize it as, they don't find me attractive.
We really have to look at the emotional barrier this physiological reality creates.
Mm-hmm.
Because the body equates physical intimacy with a burning building, the emotional landscape inevitably equates vulnerability with danger.
Right.
Early trauma links vulnerability directly with harm. For a survivor, letting their guard down was historically the exact precursor to being deeply violated.
So it's not just the physical act, it's the emotional openness.
Exactly. Therefore, forming secure emotional bonds in adulthood requires overcoming this immense internal barrier. Intimacy demands vulnerability, but vulnerability triggers the amygdala.
It is a devastating paradox.
It really is.
The very act of trying to achieve closeness becomes the trigger for the fear. The sources explicitly note that this results in mistrust toward adult partners and a persistent fear of emotional closeness.
Right.
And this is where the dynamic bleeds out from the individual and kind of poisons the relational space.
Right. It does.
The partner is trying to offer love. They are trying to create a safe container, but their attempts to move closer are just met with a wall.
The misinterpretation happens because the freeze response of trauma looks practically identical to the cold shoulder of emotional withdrawal.
Oh, wow. That makes so much sense.
Right. When the sympathetic nervous system hits the brakes on a sexual encounter, the survivor might dissociate, go completely rigid, or pull away physically, without being able to articulate why.
Because they can't speak in that state.
Right. The language centers of the brain often just shut down during a trauma response.
Broca's area goes offline.
Exactly. So the partner on the other side doesn't see the internal HPA axis firing.
They don't see the amygdala hijacking the nervous system.
No. What they see is the person they love going cold, avoiding eye contact, and pulling away from their touch.
And human beings are deeply social creatures.
Very much so.
Physical touch is one of our most primal languages for safety, belonging, and desirability, so they feel rejected. Which brings us to a really fascinating turn in the stack of sources.
This part is wild.
It really is. We've just spent time looking at an involuntary survival-based disruption of intimacy.
Right.
But the Thinkaverse materials provided a compelling parallel set of sources looking at men who intentionally practice interrupted sex, specifically pausing or stopping sexual activity before ejaculation.
Yeah.
And what is wild to me is how this voluntary, conscious physical disruption hijacks the relational dynamics using almost the exact same mechanisms we just discussed.
The comparison is so illuminating because it proves that whenever the natural cycle of physiological arousal is disrupted,
regardless of whether the brain is doing it involuntarily out of fear or voluntarily out of a specific belief.
Right. There's a massive psychological and relational toll. The biological system demands a specific resolution, and denying it just creates chaos.
Okay, let's break down the mechanics of this intentional disruption.
Sure.
The sources detail that men practicing this often do so under the umbrella of semen retention.
Right, that's a common term for it.
And the motivation seemed to stem from beliefs that ejaculating depletes vital energy, mental clarity, or, you know, masculine drive.
Yes, or some are doing it to extend the duration of physical pleasure, riding the wave of arousal without letting it crest, essentially.
They go into the act with an expectation of a massive benefit. Like, they believe they will emerge feeling like a highly focused, energized version of themselves.
Yet, the texts point out a massive, often destabilizing gap between those expectations and the actual biological reality.
What actually happens in the body?
Well, when the human body enters a state of high sexual arousal, it isn't just generating a mild physical sensation.
Right.
It is generating a massive accumulation of physiological tension. Heart rate increases, blood pressure rises, and there is profound localized vasocongestion.
Meaning blood rushing to the pelvic region.
Exactly. The nervous system is building toward a crescendo that is biologically programmed to release through orgasm and ejaculation.
Because that release is what triggers the chemicals, right?
Yeah. Yes. That release triggers this massive wash of prolactin, oxytocin, and endorphins that downregulate the nervous system, back to a parasympathetic resting state.
So when a man continuously interrupts that cycle right before the release, what is happening internally?
It's intense.
I imagine it's like trying to run two completely incompatible operating systems on a computer at the exact same time.
That is a great way to describe it.
You have the biological hardware running the arousal and release OS, which is demanding climax to reset the system.
Right.
But the conscious mind is forcing the energy retention OS, actively suppressing the hardware's natural function. The CPU must just get completely overloaded.
The cognitive dissonance is staggering.
I bet.
I mean, the mental effort required to constantly monitor arousal levels, pull back from the edge, and suppress the biological mandate for release. It requires immense psychological bandwidth.
So they don't actually feel energized?
Usually not. Instead of feeling energized, the sources note that these men often experience profound frustration, irritability, and severe underlying tension. Because the physical vasocongestion doesn't just instantly vanish because the mind decided to stop.
Right, the blood is still there.
The pelvic floor muscles remain engorged and tense. The sympathetic nervous system remains highly engaged, but it is denied the parasympathetic resolution.
They are essentially revving the car engine while stuck in neutral.
Yes.
The RPMs are redlining, the engine is running incredibly hot, but because they refuse to put the car in drive and let that kinetic energy move the vehicle forward,
the energy has nowhere to
go. It just violently shakes the frame of the car.
Exactly.
And as we mentioned earlier, when a car is shaking that violently, the passenger is going to feel it just as much as the driver.
And this is where the parallel to the trauma survivor becomes so incredibly clear.
Yeah.
In the trauma scenario, the body involuntarily hits the brakes out of fear.
Right.
In the retention scenario, the mind voluntarily hits the brakes out of belief.
But in both situations, the encounter abruptly halts.
The shared bonding process is severed.
The sources are unequivocal about the relational ripple effect here.
Oh, absolutely.
Whether the interruption is involuntary trauma or voluntary semen retention, it strains the relationship dynamics to the breaking point.
It does.
It creates massive communication difficulties and leaves the partner feeling intensely isolated.
We have to look at the evolutionary biology of attachment to understand the partner's response here.
Okay, lay that out for us.
For most couples, sexual activity is not merely a physical act, you know?
Right, it's way more than that.
It is the primary avenue for expressing mutual desire, emotional closeness, and exclusivity.
Yeah.
So when a man practicing interrupted sex suddenly stops the encounter, rolls over, or shifts the dynamic to avoid climax, the partner experiences this abrupt, jarring cessation of connection.
But I want to push back on this a little bit on behalf of the person doing the interrupting.
Sure.
If someone is practicing retention because they genuinely believe it is improving their health, or if a survivor is freezing up because they are literally trapped in a biological flashback,
right.
Isn't it unfair for the partner to take that personally? Like, why is the partner's default assumption always, they must not desire me?
It seems like they should know better, right?
Yeah, yeah. Shouldn't a mature partner be able to look at the situation objectively and say, this is about their trauma or this is about their retention practice? It has absolutely nothing to do with my attractiveness.
Logically, yes. A partner can be told that.
Mm-hmm.
And they can understand it logically.
What?
But emotionally and biologically, no.
Really?
We cannot simply logic our way out of our own neurobiology.
Just like the survivor can't.
Exactly. Just as the trauma survivor's amygdala overrides their logic to perceive a threat, the partner's amygdala overrides their logic to perceive rejection.
Wow, okay.
We are hardwired to interpret sexual withdrawal as emotional withdrawal.
Because of that evolutionary attachment.
Right. When someone we love, someone we are being deeply physically vulnerable with, suddenly pulls away, our brain registers it as a threat to the attachment bond.
So the partner's own sympathetic nervous system flares up.
Yes. They feel the sting of rejection, the erosion of feeling desired.
The sources specifically highlight how the encounter stops being a shared intimate experience and becomes this confusing, functionally incomplete event.
Right.
So the partner is having their own mini fight or flight response to the perceived rejection.
While the survivor or the retention practitioner is dealing with their own internal dysregulation.
You literally have two dysregulated nervous systems lying in the exact same bed.
Totally unable to co-regulate.
Because neither one understands the biological reality of what the other is actually experiencing.
It creates a vicious cycle of silence and misunderstanding.
Yeah.
The partner feels rejected, so they approach the next sexual encounter with hesitation, anxiety, and, you know, a protective emotional wall.
which the other person feels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
The person interrupting the sex feels that anxiety radiating off their partner, which only increases their own tension or triggers their trauma schema even further, making the next interruption even more likely.
And silence breeds resentment.
And resentment kills intimacy faster than almost anything else.
The texts make it incredibly clear that this cycle will spin infinitely until it is intentionally broken.
Yes, it requires an intervention.
So how do we break it? What does this mean for you, the listener, if you are navigating this terrain right now?
There is a way out.
How do you move from this biological isolation back to true, safe intimacy? The sources provide a highly detailed roadmap for rebuilding safely.
They do, and it requires attacking the problem from both the psychological and the relational angle simultaneously.
Right. So let's look at the first step for trauma survivors, because the texts are unequivocal on this. Professional trauma-informed therapy is non-negotiable.
Absolutely non-negotiable.
This is not a communication issue you can just talk your way out of on a Saturday night.
No. Because we're dealing with deeply entrenched cognitive schemas and autonomic nervous system dysregulation, you need a professional to help reconstruct that internal filing system.
What kind of therapy are they talking about?
Therapies like EMDR or somatic experiencing. They help the brain decouple the sensory inputs of intimacy from the amygdala's fear response.
So it actually rewires the hardware.
The internal work must focus on regulating the nervous system so that the body can actually learn to stay in a parasympathetic state when physical closeness occurs.
But the sources also emphasize that the clinical work has to be matched by relational work at home, right?
Yes, the therapy alone isn't enough if the home environment isn't safe.
Rebuilding relies entirely on transparent dialogue. And I don't just mean talking about your day.
No.
I mean explicitly, almost clinically at first, discussing boundaries, motivations, and what actual physiological safety feels like.
The texts suggest that expressing needs clearly is the absolute cornerstone of this process.
But that's so hard.
It is. For a trauma survivor, expressing a need is an act of immense courage. It requires pushing past the suffocating shame of the trauma schema to articulate, you know, this specific pressure on my shoulder feels grounding and safe, but this specific movement makes my chest tighten and my breathing shallow.
It is about moving the implicit into the explicit.
Exactly.
We often assume that intimacy should be natural, unspoken, this intuitive dance.
But when the neurobiology has been altered, you cannot rely on intuition.
You are essentially learning a completely new language together.
Yes, a brand new language.
You cannot expect your partner to read your mind, and the partner cannot assume that a sigh, a shift in weight, or a closed eye means what they think it means.
Right, a closed eye could mean deep pleasure.
Or it can mean dissociation.
Exactly. You have to sit down outside the bedroom and explicitly define the vocabulary of your boundaries.
Right. What does the word stop literally mean for us? What does safe actually feel like in your body?
The texts focus heavily on how partners can support this healing process, and the mandate is very clear. Prioritize promoting bodily safety and pleasure entirely on the survivor's terms.
That feels like a crucial distinction. Entirely on their terms.
Yes. This means removing the goal of intercourse or climax completely from the table for a period of time.
Wow, just taking it off the menu entirely.
If the goal is always traditional sex, the biological pressure will constantly trigger the performance anxiety or the trauma response.
So intimacy must be redefined.
Exactly. It might mean lying side by side, fully clothed, holding hands, and just practicing deep breathing to keep the nervous system regulated.
That makes a lot of sense.
The partner must move at a glacial pace, validating the survivor's experience without a hint of defensiveness.
That non-defensiveness is so critical. Because if the survivor says, "I'm starting to panic, we need to stop," and the partner sighs in frustration or takes it personally,
the survivor's amygdala logs that as, "See, my vulnerability caused conflict. It is not safe."
Boom, confirmation of the schema.
Right. But if the partner immediately stops, offers regulating comfort, and says, "Thank you for telling me, we are perfectly safe."
The survivor's brain logs a new contradictory data point.
Yes. It says, "I was vulnerable, I set a boundary, and I was respected and kept safe."
And that repetition of safety over months and years is what physically rewires the trauma schema.
It is. Now, the application for couples navigating intentional practices like interrupted sex requires the exact same level of radical transparency.
Right, because we can't forget about them.
The partner practicing retention cannot just abruptly halt the physical connection to serve their internal goal.
The sources stress that they must openly discuss the why behind the practice well in advance.
Yes. They need to articulate, you know, I am practicing this for these specific energetic or personal reasons, but it is paramount to me that you still feel deeply desired and loved.
So they have to ask, how can we structure our intimacy so that my practice does not result in your isolation?
Exactly. It requires redefining the entire sexual script.
Maybe the focus shifts heavily to the partner's pleasure, ensuring they reach their own physiological and emotional resolution.
Or maybe it involves extended aftercare, you know, deep emotional bonding, holding, and verbal affirmation after the physical act stops.
Bridging that gap so the partner's attachment system feels secure.
Right. It prevents the feelings of rejection and ensures both individuals feel respected.
But both scenarios require an incredible, often really uncomfortable amount of vulnerability.
Oh, massive amounts.
The person interrupting the sex has to explain their deeply personal, sometimes fragile motivations or traumas.
And the partner has to swallow their pride and be vulnerable enough to admit, when you pull away, it terrifies me. It makes me feel unwanted.
Without that transparent, deeply uncomfortable dialogue, you just have two people silently suffering in the same bed, their nervous systems warring with each other.
Yeah.
But the profoundly hopeful message embedded throughout all of these Thinkiverse articles is that recovery, growth, and intensely joyful intimacy are entirely possible.
It really is the ultimate takeaway.
By integrating the internal psychological healing with the external relational communication, couples can achieve a depth of nuanced, empathetic care that most people never experience.
It's true.
When you have to deconstruct your entire concept of intimacy down to the studs, examine every biological reaction, and rebuild it from the ground up together.
The bond you create is infinitely stronger.
It's more intentional and more resilient than if you had simply relied on the default programming.
You move from a state of passive, assumption-based intimacy to active, consciously constructed connection.
You are no longer at the mercy of the biological defaults. You are the architects of your shared experience.
Well said.
Let's bring all of this together. We have traversed some incredibly complex terrain today.
We definitely have.
We started by looking at the invisible, often terrifying architecture of childhood sexual trauma. We saw how those extreme events neuroplastically rewrite a person's sexual self schema, turning the promise of connection into a biological threat.
Right. We examined the mechanics of the autonomic nervous system.
How the amygdala can hijack the body in milliseconds.
Flooding the system with cortisol and completely overriding the logical prefrontal cortex.
And we saw how that physiological dysfunction creates profound emotional barriers, leaving survivors feeling betrayed by their own bodies and terrified of the vulnerability they desperately crave.
And then we explored the fascinating parallel of intentional, voluntary disruptions like interrupted sex and semen retention.
We saw how attempting to force a cognitive goal over a biological mandate creates massive cognitive dissonance,
resulting in physiological tension, frustration, and a hijacked reward circuitry.
Ultimately, we saw that whether the disruption is an involuntary trauma freeze or a voluntary retention choice, the relational fallout is remarkably identical.
The partner is left feeling confused, isolated, and rejected.
Their own attachment system triggered into a defensive posture, creating a vicious cycle of silence.
But we also mapped the way out.
Yes, we did. We discussed the absolute necessity of trauma-informed therapy to regulate the nervous system.
We talked about establishing explicit boundaries, moving from implicit assumptions to a clearly defined vocabulary of safety.
We saw how partners can support healing by prioritizing safety, moving slowly, and removing the pressure of traditional sexual goals.
By bringing these hidden biological mechanisms into the light through radical communication and deep empathy,
it is entirely possible to reclaim bodily safety and rebuild a truly joyful, secure sexual relationship.
It is entirely possible to heal.
As we wrap up today's deep dive, we usually like to leave you with something to keep turning over in your mind, something that builds on everything we've uncovered in these sources.
Yes, we spent this time establishing a foundational truth.
Mm.
Our internal sexual self schemas can be profoundly, tragically altered by the extreme negative events of trauma.
Right.
And we've seen how our physiological responses can be actively manipulated by intentional practices like interrupted sex.
Both of these realities highlight the sheer, staggering neuroplasticity of human sexuality.
Exactly. So if our internal maps of intimacy are that malleable, capable of being radically rewritten by external traumas or intentional habits, it raises a really fascinating possibility.
What's that?
Could we, as adults, consciously and collaboratively design entirely new sexual schemas with our partners.
Oh, wow.
If the brain can learn profound fear, it can absolutely learn profound safety. Could we sit down and essentially write our own custom blueprints for intimacy from scratch?
Blueprints that are completely independent of our biological defaults.
Independent of societal expectations and independent of our past histories.
Imagine the sheer freedom in realizing that the map of your intimacy isn't just something you are forced to read.
Right. It is a canvas, and you have the power to draw it yourselves.
A phenomenal concept to mull over as you navigate your own relationships. Thank you to the listener who provided this incredibly rich, challenging stack of sources today.
Yes, thank you.
Taking the time to understand the biological and psychological realities beneath our interactions validates your dedication to being a thoughtful, well-informed, and deeply empathetic partner. We are honored to do this research with you. Until next time, keep exploring the deep end.